Accession number 28645, rule 26.
It's interesting that you, with your married life, was quite disjointed and broken, long periods of separation, ultimately in a complete period of separation. And your parents' marriage, for whatever reason, and of course things were different in those days, people did go to the colonies or whatever it may be for great long periods, was also characterized by long periods of separation. Would that be right?
Until, oh yes,
you know,
yes indeed.
Until your father perhaps...
But that was because...
Retired.
My mother... Well, she never really wanted to get married. It all sort of happened to her. And, oh yes, her guardian. And she told me once, her guardian said to her, you better take him because you'll never get anybody else. You're not attractive enough.
Well, judging from that photograph over there, what absolute nonsense.
Well, yes, it was. It was nonsense.
She didn't believe it, I hope.
Oh, yes, she did. She believed it all. She wasn't told about the facts of life until she got married. They told her nothing.
That was not unusual, was it, or was it?
I would say probably it was not unusual. But she did try to run away. She went to Germany and got a job with a German countess over there who kept wolfhounds, and she used to take 6 wolfhounds for walks.
When would this be?
That would be where she got married in 1910, so that would be, I suppose, about a year beforehand. Because my father went and got her back, fetched her back.
When they were engaged, or
yeah.
She ran away.
Mm. So they were never, what shall I say, closely knit. I mean, she didn't want to do the sort of things he wanted to do. And he never really understood her. But definitely a mismatch.
I get the impression sometimes when one looks at people from that age group, people born in the century now previous to the last century, certainly people pre 1890, that men did not make great effort to know their wives.
Oh no, they didn't. They just expected them to housekeep and bear children. That was it. No, I don't think they. Carlyle, for instance, he treated his wife abominably.
I didn't. Who was that name?
Carlyle. The writer. Carlyle.
Oh, Carlyle. Mm. Oh, I'm sorry. The Victorian.
Yes, my mother.
Writer, yes.
My mother had her letters, and he was always grumbling about things.
Your
no, they didn't try to understand their wives. No.
I'm sorry, you said your mother had. I didn't catch what you said.
Mrs. Carlyle's letters.
How did she come by those?
Well, no, not the originals, the book.
Oh, I see.
Hmm.
Well, Suzanne, we've got 15 minutes left on this tape. Is there anything that you would like to add to your Devon Devonian reminiscences?
Now let me think. Well, there were all sorts of nice things that happened. For instance, there would be the time when all the field was in full of hay, because we never mowed it, of course. It was cut for hay, and the farmer cut it in return for having the hay. But I remember that when the grass was tall, almost every grass head had a common blue butterfly sitting on it. Hundreds of butterflies. Hundreds.
No insecticides, of course, to kill them.
No, none at all. We didn't use it. We didn't use it, the poison at all, and things didn't get eaten. I don't know. And the peas grew, and the beans grew, and everything grew. Lettuces. Oh, I do remember there were caterpillars. There were caterpillars. And they used to get into the cauliflowers. And sometimes the cook didn't absolutely wash the cauliflower all as well as she might, and one of these things would float to the surface on your plate. Oh, and then there were, yes, her servants, my mother. She really did manage to employ the most extraordinary succession of servants. First, I did start on the Gales, Mr. and Mrs. Gale. They left finally, I think they retired. And then we had somebody called Miss Rydell. And she was definitely balmy, quite definitely. But she was also of the lady class, so she ate with us at meals. And the trouble was, she used to tell stories, and my friend and I were. It was terrible. We could hardly contain our giggles. It was dreadful. And she was quite mad. And finally, my mother decided she couldn't stand it any longer, so she bought her a little two-room cottage and sent her off to live there. And she lived there till she died. And she wrote regular letters to my mother, grumbling about the cottage and why hadn't she got her something different. And my mother paid her a weekly allowance until she died. Kept her going. After that, we had a good lady called Miss Malmsey, and she was definitely not very adept at cooking. However, one day she cooked a treacle pudding, golden syrup pudding. She turned this thing out onto the dish and bore it aloft into the dining room, and she slipped. So in order to save the pudding, she jammed the dish up against the wall. But the pudding was slippery, so it slipped higher. So she followed it up with the dish. And she continued it up as far as she possibly could, and every time she tried to get it off the wall, it slipped a bit further up. And there was golden syrup streaming down the wall, golden syrup streaming down her hair, and finally, in one last push, she managed to get it up to the ceiling. It shot out and landed on her head. Of course, we at the table were helpless, completely helpless. That was Miss Malmsey. Then we got an incompetent gardener, and he married an incompetent wife. And she used to try and knit
and
for...
And they had incompetent children.
Well, there was one on the way. And she was knitting for it. She was knitting a pair of socks. And they went on and on and on and on. And my mother would look at them and she'd say, "No, that's not quite right, dear. It ought to be shorter." And the next time my mother went into the kitchen, "I ripped it out, Mum." I don't think she ever got a pair of socks knitted. This child was born, oh dear. And so we housed them, gave them a room. And we were finally, when she sold the house, John was still there. Oh, we had one good gardener in between. And the people all surrounded my mother, the village people, and they said, "Oh dear, we shall miss those beautiful flowers that you sell all the time." He'd had the lot. I think he came from Cornwall. It was not a good idea. Finally, my mother had to get rid of the girl because she was absolutely impossible. But she had a series of lame ducks. It
yeah,
was
I was
the
about
same
to say,
thing.
These are your mother's lame ducks.
Those are my mother's lame ducks of the servant class, as it were. Well, we had one lady and she only stayed a month, unfortunately, and she was a brilliant cook. I can still remember her cooking. But we were below her notice. We weren't good enough, so she went and got another job. Yes, she had the lame ducks in the kitchen and in the garden, and then she had the other collection of lame ducks who were the missionaries who came back from India. Or whatever. Whatever she happened to find. She always seemed to have plenty of lame ducks. There was one called Mabel. Did I tell you about Mabel?
Yes.
She was a dumpy little soul, Mabel. Ate too much. So she spent a good deal of her time looking after these people, and the rest of her time she spent writing, or gardening, or travelling.
Of which she did a very great deal.
Yes, she did quite a bit of travelling while I was at school. A friend of hers brought things back from Italy. We did the journey with the books falling off the back of the cart.
Yes.
Yes, she did a lot of interesting things and knew a lot of interesting people. She knew the elite literate people in Italy. She knew them, group of them, knew them very well. I can't remember their names now. And then she did a lot of teaching in Venice. She had a presentation of religious books from the man in Venice, the patriarch, which I've still got. I don't know what to do with her books. I could think I ought to go to a religious person, because she's got missals and she's got many annotated religious books. She was extremely spiritual. I can't think where to send them. I wish I could.
Some sort of historical religious society in some way, or the historical branch of a missionary society, or a society that is connected with where your mother was, something like that, I would have thought.
It wants somebody who's interested in the spiritual development of a soul, really. It's pretty profound stuff. And she spent her life considering that everything she did was wrong. She was brought up like that. She was told everything she did was wrong.
Can I ask how much you think that applies to you as well?
I wasn't told everything was wrong. Oh, I don't know. I've never had self-confidence. I mean, all my life, it's always been an effort to go into a public place, into a restaurant or anything like that. I have to steel myself to going into it.
Because you're concerned that people will think you're inadequate, or you'll make some sort of social faux pas? Or
no, I'm just shy of going into a public place.
But then I would have to ask the question, why are you shy?
No idea. Something in my upbringing, I suppose.
You see, there's something, I mean, you've said it about your mother, very much indeed, the negation, almost rooting out of what one could describe as the joyful, things that were joyful, were
wrong
or discounted, mm-hmm. or in your mother's life. And I sometimes, you know, I know we still have lots and lots of gaps in your story, but we have broadly, in one sense, now this afternoon, covered your story from 1915 to today, broadly, in very broad sense.
Yes.
And it just strikes me that there are elements of a replication of your mother's story in yours.
Well, that would seem to be a natural progression.
You think it's an innate and natural thing. Do you?
A lot of the things that I've missed because I haven't had the confidence to take them up. I mean, I know I say that I've missed opportunities, but it's because very often I haven't had the courage to take them up because I haven't thought I was good enough.
And do you think this self-limiting of yourself is something that is innate in your character or something that you learnt from your parents, in particular your mother?
Well, you naturally learn from your parents. I mean, you absorb it. You can't help it. But I must say, I don't think some of the children today absorb anything from their parents. That's another matter. I don't really know. I suppose it's... I don't know. I know that I've never had self-confidence. If I've undertaken a job, I've been very good at it.
Yet that has not given you self-confidence.
No, I've just been devoted to the job.
But can you be devoted to a job if underlying at the back of your mind is this lack of self-confidence?
Oh yes, you can. Oh yes, you can do a job well.
While still thinking that you might not, or that you can't.
Well, you don't think that way. It just affects the way you act. But you don't think it. I mean, you don't sit down and say, oh, I'm not worth anything. But when it comes to a decision of undertaking something or going out somewhere, it just clicks in and there it is.
So it's an unconscious. So rather than being a conscious feeling of lack of self-worth, it's an unconscious...
Yes, it just affects your decisions and your actions. But you don't sit down and say, I've got an inferiority complex, so I'm not going out to dinner. But it might affect your decision not to go out to dinner. But you wouldn't give it a reason. I've never really thought about it. But I do know that I've missed opportunities by not having the go to have the self-confidence to think that it was something I must do. Is it partly a laziness? I don't know. Sometimes I think that the evil fairy at my christening was laziness. Not doing a thing, letting it slip. And yet I can work very hard.
And that was what I was going to say. Yet you can work very hard. You were disciplined to produce a great deal of artistic work and to learn about it. And you were disciplined enough to become vice president, president for 25 years over the period of... and build up an important society which has become, which has been, your work has been publicly...
And founded another, which I haven't mentioned.
I know. I know there are others that are missing.
I founded the SBA, which has spread over the whole world.
What is the SBA?
Society of Botanical Artists. I founded them and now the whole world has copied us. I was the founder president of that. I retired from that last year as well because I was ill. But I did all the work for that, all the finances, and I kept all the accounts.
When did you found it?
85, that is to say I had the first exhibition. What happened was that the Mauer Galleries, they asked the five directors to think up an exhibition because we didn't have any bookings and we thought we'd better have an exhibition and try and get some money in. And So I was asked if I would do one, so I put my thinking cap on and I said, yes, I'll do one. I'll do one called Flowers and Gardens, which is still the name of the exhibition. And so I put that on in 84. And in 85, oh dear, yes, 85 I had this idea that I might found a society. But again, I dithered about it, you know, I thought it was just an idea. Then my mother died. She died on the 10th of April, and on the 11th of April I had to be in London for the opening of the SBA, which wasn't yet the SBA. And so I vaguely said to somebody, what do you think if I found a society? And they all grabbed onto it, and they grabbed onto it so firmly I couldn't get out of it again, even though I dithered. So I founded it the day after my mother's death. That was a dreadful day, that was. But I knew what she would say to me. I knew that she'd be very displeased with me if I didn't go. So I went. It was like a dream. I moved and I spoke without any plan. It just happened.
Like you have said in the past, so much else in your life has happened. I think you said the expression that
my
your
life
has lived you, not you have lived your
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely. That's very true.
I think there's a difference between that and laziness, you know. There's a great difference between that and laziness.
Yes, probably. Because I'm not lazy when